The whole purpose of the Bhagavat is to cultivate in souls pure love of God. Ahaitukya pratiyata bhakti. That is to say, unremitting, selfless love of God. And this is the sum and substance of the Bhagavad Purana. It is to inculture affection for the Lord. And anything that is considered a distraction from that is considered undesirable. Something we want to avoid. Anything that will interrupt the flow of devotion toward God is something that we wish to stay away from. And those things which inspire the devotion to God, we gravitate toward. This is part of the bhakti process. I think it is important to know that we are speaking here about a text that is very much representing Vedic society. We are talking about a process of Varnashrama Dharma. This verse is spoken within the context of Varnashrama Dharma. It is a context in which society was designed in such a way as to create the gradual elevation of souls toward liberation and finally toward prema bhakti. The Bhagavat's emphasis on Vedic society is natural because it comes out of the Vedic era. This is the function. Back in those days, it didn't matter whether one was a devotee or not. One was gradually elevated. We have that funny expression in English, willy-nilly. That is to say, without one's will. It was done as a matter of course. Over lifetimes, one would progress up the Varna ladder to greater and greater levels of awareness of the universe, and ultimately to transcendence, and ultimately to the personality of Godhead. In Kali Yuga, it is quite a different situation. Society is designed for the downfall of human beings. Even the most innocent and pure-hearted person is implicated toward sin, implicated toward bad effects. We may have the best of intentions in devotional service, and we open up a bank account, we put some money into the account, we even plan to give all of the money in Krishna's service. But do you know what the bank does with the money? They lend the money to business people. And what kind of businesses could they be? Unmentionable things half the time. We are then, in some sense, funding businesses that are very undesirable, very much, maybe even evil businesses of different kinds, like a slaughterhouse. Someone comes into the bank, they want to open up slaughterhouse, may I take a loan? Oh yes, we have Krishna Das's money here, and we'd be happy to lend it to you. In Kali Yuga, we are implicated towards sin. In the Vedic society, we are implicated toward liberation. You don't even have to try. Over many births, one just becomes more and more attuned to liberation, transcendence, ultimately Krishna bhakti. Kali Yuga, it is the opposite. No matter how much we try, there is so much fault in this age. In Vedic society, there were specific roles and places for men and women. Those places were very well defined. It was never the case that a woman went out and had to work. A woman always raised the children. And it was considered a very glorious task, because to raise children properly is a wonderful thing. The men and the women who become adults take up the varnas and ashrams of society, and that affects all of society. So society, the health of society begins with womanhood and motherhood. When that breaks down, then all of society breaks down. So society was arranged in a very structured way, and tasks were not questioned. It was something that was fairly natural and automatic. One's swadharma, one's natural calling in society, what one does in society, it fell into place. It was very harmonious. In Kali Yuga, show me one thing that is harmonious in Kali Yuga. It is just not the fact. Well, we're speaking here about the place of women. We're talking about the place of women in Kali Yuga. We're not saying, Govinda, yes. We're not Achyuta. No, it's too onomatopoeic with the sneezing sound. But it says in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, one says Govinda when a Vaishnava sneezes. This one. Not Achyuta. Anyway, I'm on this mission to stop this Achyuta business with Govinda is a proper way to. Anyway, so what we have then is in Vedic society, we have a very carved out role for everybody. And it was very natural. It was not something artificial. It was not something forced. It was something that it had a very natural flow to it. Kali Yuga, there are no natural flows. Especially in this day and age, women are expected to be like men. Women want to be like men. Men want women to be like men, and so on and so forth. The fact is, women and men are different. Women and men have a different psychology. They develop at different rates. Modern psychology shows this. In Daiva Varnashrama, as opposed to Vedic Varnashrama, we have not the concern about whether one is a man or a woman. Life is very short. It is... Life is short, and the whole purpose of the Sankirtan movement is to take up the bhakti process as rapidly as possible. There is no time to pursue the Vedic process. There is no time to perform the Vedic yajna. The yajna of the age, of course, as we know, is the Sankirtan yajna. And Daiva Varnashrama means here that one is not in the carved roles of Vedic Varnashrama any longer, but rather one takes up Varna and Ashram only as it serves Sankirtana Yajna. Plain and simple. We have a problem in ISKCON. We think that we're supposed to be Vedic men and women. I was counseling a couple at one point, and the husband of the couple called me up one day and said, "Garuda, I know what's wrong with my marriage. I figured it out." I said, "Great, wonderful. What's wrong with your marriage?" "But what's wrong with my marriage is that my wife is not a Vedic wife." I said, "This is a wonderful realization." I said, "May I ask you a question?" He said, "Of course." I said, "But I'm very happy. I've realized this." I said, "It's wonderful. It's really, it's truly wonderful. Let me ask you this. Are you a Vedic husband?" Meanwhile, she's working. She's making the money. He has a lower paying part-time job, right? It is artificial to impose the Vedic ethics, the Vedic structures, in an age when it doesn't fit. I'm glad to see I have at least one person in support. That is superb.
Thank you.
So the idea then is that that this idea that we are to take up Vedic Varnashrama is really erroneous. Now, that is not to say that we don't draw heavily from the Vedic example, from the Vedic principles. This is not to be denied. This is why we take shelter of the Bhagavata Purana. There are jewels of spiritual guidance and realizations that we embody more than anything else. At the same time, we have to be careful how this is applied. So the issue, the impression that somehow women are less intelligent than men, I think I'm supposed to talk about misconceptions in ISKCON, am I? Yeah, because I'm not going to be here tomorrow evening. So we're collapsing that talk with this class. But what a perfect time in which to do this. But the idea that women are less intelligent than men, that is true. Women are less intelligent than men in the ways that men tend to be intelligent. But the converse is also true, that women are more intelligent than men in the ways that women tend to be intelligent. There are two different kinds of intelligences, and they are engaged in devotional service, they are engaged in the family. That is why Krishna put a man and a woman in charge of raising children, because they each have a unique intelligence for that process of raising a human being. Both are needed. Anyone here who is a parent can testify to the fact that when we males think that something is good for the child and it really is not quite right for the child, there is a kind of intelligence that kicks in from the mother that is very powerful and very important and very healthy for the child. Just even in one's experience, one can feel this. But forget about experience for the moment. Go back to the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna talks about women as a class and women as being perhaps part of the sort of outer echelons of society. But he also says that he is the embodiment of feminine qualities. And one of them is medha, which is intelligence. So is Krishna contradicting himself here? I don't think so. Intelligence is a quality of a woman. But it's a womanly intelligence. This is not to be denied. It's not to be reduced to something less than a man's intelligence. It is simply different. There was even a study at the University of Virginia recently where a gentleman, a professor, they're not always gentlemen professors, I mean, myself, of course, an exception. But there is a professor who has done a study who finally comes out and says that women and men are not the same. Sometimes what happens in education is that the most obvious things suddenly become an amazing fact. Now, of course, we can understand this on a physical level. Men and women are not the same. And I'm not going to review the details there. Emotionally, they're not the same. And nor should they be. Intellectually, even, they're not the same. Part of what has happened in the latter part of the 20th century with women's studies, and I was at Harvard at a time doing graduate studies there, and I was there at a time when women's studies was in a boom phase. And I saw, I didn't quite understand it at the time. I was this lonely devotee going to school, getting a doctorate, and there weren't too many people to talk to about this kind of thing, but I would be encountering so many things that would come up in the academy. One of these things was women's studies was just taking over the place. I mean, there were all these women running it back and forth campus, and they were all excited. And I finally went to a female professor and asked her, I said, can I ask you, what's the big deal here? What's going on? Women's studies, what is it about? I didn't understand. She said that history has been dominated by the male eyes. History has been constructed through the vision of a male. And males tend to focus on certain things and exclude other things. And she said, because of that, history has been, in some sense, deprived of a complete view. Because women tend to focus on other things, we have now an opportunity to put together a greater picture of history if we can access feminine sources. Well, I thought this was fascinating. I thought it was genuinely fascinating. So suddenly, it was important to look at documents that were connected with women because that gave a different piece of history. So from an intellectual standpoint, there is this confirmation that women's and men's intelligences and perceptions are a bit different. This can be utilized so nicely in Christian service, and indeed is utilized so nicely in Christian service. There are things that women tend to do better than men, and there are things that men tend to do better than women, but not absolutely. So, for example, if you look at elementary school education, generally, women tend to be the teachers because they're more patient, for one thing. I am a professor at a university, but I don't know if I could go into a class of second graders for more than 5 minutes. So I'm used to walking into a classroom with dozens and dozens of people, and when I walk in, everyone gets quiet, and they wait to listen. Walking into a room full of second graders is like walking into cosmic chaos. All is out of control with the world. This being thrown and that, and the energy is just going out everywhere. Right? I don't know how they do it. Women have an intelligence that can be engaged beautifully in that kind of arena. I'm not saying that men cannot do this, but it's unlikely, gentlemen. Okay? It's unlikely. Even in the course of higher education, again, very interesting to see what is happening. What sorts of things are studied, what sorts of things are looked at from the feminine point of view or from a masculine point of view. So in the case of a covered well, and in the case of the association of men with women, in the case of distractions, what we're speaking about here in Kali Yuga is hardly that women are the only distraction for men, or that men would be the distraction for women. But really, there is any number of things that are distractions in Kali Yuga. And just about everything is distracted. Perhaps the worst of which would be the mind. Our own minds are our greatest distractions. And this is the apparatus that needs to be somehow under control. Once that is under control, then everything else can be more easily controlled. The sense of the experience of calming the mind and the ability to develop a buddhi, discernment. To know what is distracting, to know what is engaging positively in Krishna consciousness. This is buddhi yoga, the yoga of discernment. So the problem of understanding women's roles in Krishna consciousness or women's roles in society really is very simple. It is a matter of survival in Kali Yuga. We don't oftentimes go through the ashrams in order. Have you noticed that? Sometimes a man may take sannyas and then he becomes a grihastha. So be it. In Vedic Varnashrama, that is what we call a fall down. It's a fall down because we're not moving up. We're not progressing up a ladder that was designed to work in the Vedic age. But in Kali Yuga, recently I've been working with a former sannyasi in his intellectual work, and he is now grihastha. And someone came to me and said, "Oh, I hear such and such fell down and is now getting married." I said, "Such and such fell up," because he is now more engaged, more appropriately engaged in devotional service. The idea here is that ashrama and varna is secondary. We are grihastha, we are brahman, we are vaishya, we are brahmachari, we are sannyasi. Secondarily, we are first Krishna bhakta. Jibir sharupoi krishnir nitto dash. We are first devotee, and only secondarily are we a varna and an ashram. And those are only to be used to enhance bhakti. Sometimes I see in ISKCON, we reverse it. I am first a grihastha. Secondarily, a bhakta. That is incorrect. That is not what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught. Varna and ashram might be constituent to bhakti practice. One is not denying the importance, but only for aiding bhakti. If it is not aiding the bhakti process, it should be changed immediately. It should be rectified in some way. We don't have Vedic husbands. We don't have Vedic wives. As much as some of you ladies may try to be a Vedic wife, it is good. I'm not here to discourage anyone. But we don't have a pure Vedic wife. We don't have Vedic sannyasis. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself was not a good Vedic sannyasi. He was not. Prabhupada himself was not a Vedic sannyasi. He crossed water. You don't cross water when you're a sannyasi. These are not Vedic sannyasis. These are Vaishnava sannyasis. There is a difference. You show me a Vedic sannyasi and I'll eat my bead bag. There are no Vedic sannyasis. There are no Vedic grihasthas. There are no Vedic brahmacharis. But there are Vaishnava brahmacharis, Vaishnava grihasthas. And that is glorious. That is very glorious. And so, in this age, we function to execute devotional service as intensely and as purposefully as possible. Why are we all here? Why are we here? We are here because in all of us has been awakened a certain divine call to love. If we look at Gopinathji, if we gaze upon the form of Gopinathji, have you noticed what he's doing? He is holding the flute. He is holding the flute. My question to all of you is, how in the world can he possibly hold that flute while he is so closely situated next to Radha? No, he cannot hold that flute when Radha is right there. In fact, I was chanting in this outer room here, And notice there's a beautiful mural of Krishna holding the flute, but he's looking away from the flute, distracted by Radha, who is coming from behind him. And that's what's about to happen up there. But they are not facing one another. They are facing us because they are calling us. There is an awakening of the heart that occurs when we take up the practice of bhakti. There is an awakening of the heart. There is a call to divine love. And Radha and Krishna beckon us toward them. That is why Krishna still stands there, holding the flute, despite the fact that Radharani is right next to him. He calls us. He wants us to come to him. How many times in the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna talk about coming to him? 16. I've counted them. It is interesting how Krishna talks about how we can come to him. He passionately desires the love of souls. He wants us. He owns and controls everything in the universe. Absolutely everything in the universe. There are so many manifestations of Krishna trying to embrace us, trying to remind us that he is there. He is waiting for us. You can't see me as Bhagavat or as the Bhagavan manifestation, then let me manifest as Brahman. If you don't feel me embracing you by all-pervading spirit, then let me embrace you as Virata Rupa, the universal form. Let me embrace you in all the superlatives of this world, in all that is splendorous and beautiful in this world. Let me embrace you that way. Do you hear me? Krishna says. Do you hear me calling? That is why Krishna holds the flute while standing next to his beloved Radha. He wants us to join him. So every day we gaze upon the divine forms of Radha and Krishna. And this divine call is what our lives are all about. It's all about responding to that divine call. In light of that, can we worry about distractions? Can we worry about associating with a man or a woman in such a way as to fall down? Well, of course, the whole point is to not be distracted from the divine love call. So if one associates with the opposite sex, one associates with such a person in trying to hear the divine love call. We have to help each other in hearing that call. That is why we're here in a community. And this appears to me to be a very beautiful community in which to do that. Again, this is my first time here. I've heard about Radhadesh for so many years. I remember when the property was purchased many years ago. And people have been trying to get me to come here for so many years, but Krishna has been protecting all of you up till now. But apparently, Krishna feels that all of you are now strong enough to not step into the covered well due to my association. You see? We are all here because of Srila Prabhupada. We are all here because one amazing soul heard this call so passionately, sacrificed everything to have that call delivered to others. That is the model, that when we hear the divine call of the flute, that we absorb it and then we give it to others. It doesn't mean that we clobber people over the head with Krishna's flute, the way Bible-bearing evangelists will use the Bible to intimidate people. No. No. What we do is we reflect the beauty and attractiveness of Krishna, and we explain to others how we so much love Krishna in our behavior and through our words, by example. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that even so much philosophical discourse can even get sages arguing back and forth. But it is the behavior of a Vaishnava that that establishes the principles of religion. What is it? Dharma stapana hetu, something vyavahara, something like that. It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So the idea is that our whole lives ideally become filled with the call of Krishna, with Krishna's divine love call. And that when we absorb ourselves in that call, naturally, we will not need to worry about so many distractions. It is always good to be discerning about what may not be so good for absorbing ourselves in Krishna consciousness. But it is a positive process. Recently in a book that I'm just finishing up, I was writing that that Krishna is not a god of judgment. Krishna is not a god of punishment. Krishna is not a jealous god, as God declares himself to be in the Hebrew Bible, in the Decalogue. He's not a god of fear and threat. Rather, Krishna is a loving god. He is beautiful. He is attractive. He's... I hear an echo. Again, confirmation is good for the speaker. Yes. Krishna is a gentle deity because he does not want to force us to love him. Because to force love is no love at all. Sometimes I think devotees feel like they need to be forcing themselves to love God. Or, I don't seem to be too successful in forcing myself to love God, so let me go find a God brother or God sister and let me force them. Oh, tut bovet. Let's talk afterwards, okay? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes. So the idea is that it's not a process of force. That is not love. Love cannot be forced. Krishna understands this. Why does he talk about his love as a secret? Guhyam param yogam. These are the three words used by Sanjaya in the Bhagavad Gita to describe the whole dialogue. The secret supreme yoga. What is secret? What is secret is his love, his passionate love for souls, and his desire for them to love him. It's the only thing he does not own and control. It's the only thing we have to offer to Krishna, is our hearts. We have nothing else to offer. We may offer a flower. Flower already belongs to Krishna. It is a wonderful vehicle for offering our hearts. But frankly, the flower already belongs to Krishna. The only thing we have to offer, the only thing that's left for Krishna, who is Purnam, he is complete, he is, everything is within Krishna, but yet he is a deity who lacks something, and it is our hearts that he lacks. Bhakti is the process of offering our hearts to God. That is the essence of what it is that we do here. So, if we are to take up this process, we do it with a sense of gravity. We do it with a sense of appreciating that Krishna is waiting for us. In effect, what we have is a kind of unrequited love happening with Krishna. Krishna loves us, but we are not so much loving to Krishna. So he keeps it secret. So I may love Mahadyuti as my best friend, my old friend, old for short. What I'm saying is the friendship is old. We are both so old now, Mahadyuti. Yes. But he may not love after that. He definitely will not. He is not very loving right now toward me. So I may love him so much, but he may not love me. So do I come on strong and say, Mahadyuti, I love you as my best friend. You are my best friend, my dear friend. And he'll be looking at me like, oh, come on, Garuda, just chill. In every relationship, there must be balance according to the parameters of that relationship. Relationships thrive when there is balance, when each person in a relationship is participating as fully as they can in a reciprocal way. That is why Krishna says, Ye yatamam prabhadyante tangstataiva vijamiha. As souls submit themselves to me, I love them. I offer my love to them reciprocally. In other words, he doesn't want to come on too strong. But the secret, what Krishna calls the greatest of all secrets in the Bhagavad Gita, what he kind of hides and tucks away in the Bhagavad Gita, is something I find even we devotees don't really see in the Gita. He says his supreme word, his greatest of all secrets, is the following. And he reveals this in verse 1864, two verses before the Charama Shloka. Ishtosi me dritam iti. Such simple and powerful words. Ishtosi me dritam iti. You are so much loved by me. He puts it in quotations. He calls these words his supreme word, and he calls it guhyatamam, the greatest. Sarva guhyatamam, the greatest of all secrets. Why does he keep it secret? Because he's waiting for us to love him. That's why. That's my opinion. But I see no other reason. He already loves all souls equally. But as you know, he says, I especially love my devotee. I especially love that bhakta who delivers to other bhaktas that supreme secret. I especially love that bhakta who hears my divine call. This is what is going on even in Bhagavad Gita. Ishtosi me dritamiti. Such magical words. Vasudeva sarvamiti. Vasudeva is my everything. Such a soul, samahatma sadurlabha, such a soul is very rare, who can say, Vasudeva is everything. Of the four types of people that approach Krishna, it is the one that knows Krishna, not with just mere jnana, but it's a knowing of the heart. A knowing of the heart. Premanjana chodita bhakti valochanena santasa daiva hridayesha valokayanti yamashyama sundaram achintya guna swarupa govindam aripurusham tamaham vajami. You know this verse. This verse so beautifully expresses how there is a knowing of the heart. There is cognitive value to love. It is not merely emotional. No, flimsy, emotional. No, this is a deeply abiding affection issuing forth from the heart that actually comes to understand the achintya guna swarupam of Bhagavan. Achintya guna swarupam, that which is not comprehensible. The qualities of God that are not known, not even knowable. Unknowable is achintya, right? Jaranda. Unknowable, achintya. Not to be known, yet they're known by one who offers one's heart. The power of love. The power of loving God. The power of loving one another. I'm just running on here. It's this called, I believe, in our literature, Jiva Vega. Hmm? I'll just wind up here and then invite any of you for any comments or questions. But in the final part of a book that I published a year ago, focusing on the Rasa Lila of Krishna, the Rasa Panchadhyayi chapters of the Bhagavad. There we see how important it is, the community of devotees. The Rasa Mandala of Krishna begins when the gopis, the Vraja Gopikas, link arms together. It first takes place among bhaktas. The Rasamandala begins by bhaktas inviting Krishna into the circle. Just like there were some circles formed today, despite your statement. Circles formed right here in celebration of Krishna's names. So we bhaktas join together, and the circle is a symbol of unity. Bhaktas become united. And even though the gopis, you see the gopis, the Vraja Gopikas, in various colors of dress and garments, they're all wearing different garments and so on. They may be different, but they link arms. Even they may have some differences among themselves, but they link arms. They may have different even relationships with Krishna and Radha, but they link arms. The gopis themselves, as you know, are supposed to be the embodiments of individual emotions of Radha. So they are different, just as Radharani exhibits different emotions in her love for Krishna. But they link arms. They're joined, all of these emotions, all of these differences. We're not all supposed to be the same. We're supposed to be different. I'm so glad Mahadyuti is different than me. Because when I befriend him and interact with him, if it was me, I would be terribly bored. And as it is, I find him terribly entertaining. Differences are wonderful. We thrive on variety. All the Vraja Gopikas are different. They're different. But Krishna, when he sees the bhaktas coming together with linked arms, he then, we say expands, but multiplies, duplicates himself to each and every bhakta exclusively. So this is our process. When we come together in unity, Krishna comes to us personally. It's very sweet. This is the essence. And when we chant the Maha Mantra, which is the very way, ultimately, for us to associate with this Ras Mandala, we are, in effect, participating in that glorious, loving mandala. I claim in the end of the book that the Maha Mantra is the sonic replication of the Ras Mandala. Every time you chant around, or the mantra, you are replicating full circle. There are the alternating feminine and masculine divine names, just as we have in the Ras Mandala. And there's this circuitous arrangement, right, going around and around. When Krishna says, when Prabhupada says that when we chant the Maha Mantra, Krishna is dancing on our tongues, isn't that a no-brainer? That is not a sentimental statement, ladies and gentlemen. Krishna is dancing on our tongues because we are replicating the Ras Mandala as we chant. Think about it. There are other no-brainers. Like, for example, each of the beads in our mala, right, are supposed to be the 108 Rajagopikas, right? And then there's the Krishna bead, right? Does that sound similar to anything that you know? Perhaps the Ras Mandala? Yes? My chorus? I've gotten very attached to this corroboration group over here. Because I certainly won't get it over here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a truly magnificent process. Oddly enough, we can do things with each other that can distract one another from that very process. That is called aparada, something against worship, something that pushes someone away from worship, from their seva, to discourage someone from one's seva. Is aparada. Again, literally means against worship. Away from worship. That is aparada. We're not all gathered here to discourage one another from Krishna seva. No, we're here to link arms. We're here to inspire one another. We're here to love each of our servants. We're here to appreciate so much all the wonderful service that must go on here in this beautiful place. We're here to inspire others to join in the Ras Mandala, to understand that there is such a supreme vision of divine love. This is the greatest gift that we have to offer the world. No one else was cooperating, so So this is the greatest gift that we have. We can offer this. Every religious tradition has a great gift to offer. They have their great gifts. And we can listen lovingly and attentively to what they have to offer. But we have something very special. Very, very special. I've been teaching world religions along with specialized courses in bhakti and Sanskrit and our different literatures, Puranic literatures and so on, for years in the university setting. And I never tell my students what my preference is, although they always ask, they come up to me and they say, Dr. Schweig, what is your religion? And I say, that is a secret. Now you know what I mean, right? We can also keep secrets, right? But I said, if you really want to know by the end of the course, come to my office. And maybe I'll tell you a little bit of the secret. How can they not know what my religion is? I have a book of world religions, and then I have the Bhagavad Gita. I show them other Vedic literatures. I flood them with this stuff, and they ask me, what is my... I sit in Padmasana, yoga posture, yogasana for them, and they still don't know what my religion is. Because when I speak of Islam, when I speak of Christianity, when I speak of Confucianism and Buddhism and Judaism, I speak trying to find their secret love song. I'm trying to find the love song as it is embedded in their tradition. It may not be quite as loud as Krishna's flute, but it's there. But human beings do superb jobs in covering up people's ears. Religion is the greatest enemy of religion. Let's make sure we're not the enemy of Krishna consciousness for anybody, including ourselves. Let's make sure we really are able to put things in perspective. And if we feel that we are not able to, find someone in whom you can place your trust in broadening and deepening one's sense of what this is all about. You know, in a way, this temple room reminds me a little bit, not so much, because the other temple of Dallas. When I was visiting Dallas, I flew down to Dallas in 1974, I think, and to see Prabhupada when he arrived. He came to Dallas. And it was a big temple room. It was a very big temple room. And I remember the asana was quite high for Prabhupada there. And I haven't been back there for a while. And I remember we were all so excited. Prabhupada was there, and we were just like maniacs running from one end of the temple. We couldn't believe the deities. We were just so, I mean, it was just so enthralled. And suddenly, as Prabhupada was chanting the Maha Mantra, and I remember freezing in my footsteps and just staring at Srila Prabhupada, realizing that right in front of me was everything. Everything. And I became sort of transfixed on Prabhupada's lips as he would mouth the words of the Maha Mantra, and realized that this is why we're all here. But we must not cover the Ras Mandala, the Maha Mantra, with our misconceptions. And I believe that's why we have community. So we can put out our misconceptions and then have them corrected. So with those last words, I ask you to correct my misconceptions. Which are likely to come from over here, not over there. Any comments or corrections, please correct me on anything that I've said that is a mistake. Yes, I can always depend on Tattvavit for a good amount of correction. Yes, please, Tattvavit. Yeah.
In the Rasa Mandala, Krishna is represented as being the truth. Every two gopis in between two gopis.
Yes.
That's right, he has one gopi in each side.
Yes and no.
How do you have it in your painting? That's what I want
to
ask.
To pictorialize the Ras Mandala is impossible. Every gopi has her own Krishna. But yes, in the third verse of the fifth chapter of the Rasa Panchadhyayi, Krishna, it is described that Krishna duplicates himself into the middle of each pair of gopis. So So I go through quite a discussion on how do you count that. But you have to show the commencement of the rasmandala with two gopis, one Krishna, two gopis, one Krishna, because it is described that Krishna puts his arms around the necks of the gopis. So surely each gopi doesn't feel two arms coming from different sides, from two different Krishnas. At the same time, if you read the commentaries of Vishwanatha Chakravarti and Jiva Goswami and Baladeva Devotion and so on, you get interesting variations of an understanding. But the main point is that Krishna is exclusively there. On the other hand, if you go to the 19th or 20th verse of that same chapter, it is explained that each gopi has her own Krishna. And each gopi is completely unaware that Krishna is with anywhere else. I also suggest in the ending of this book that the rasmandala can be the most superb symbol of religious pluralism. That it's a symbol that speaks beyond the boundaries of the tradition within which it was spoken and within which it is activated, which is very unusual for symbols, because symbols usually are context-dependent, context-sensible. But here, when love is so powerfully expressed, it bursts out beyond religious boundaries. And I suggest that all religious traditions should examine this rasmandala, because it explains the problems of combining religious exclusivism, which we have too much of in the West, and inclusivism, radical inclusivism, which we have too much in the East. Religions in the East, of the East, they say, it is all one. It is all one. There are many paths, but it is all one. Okay. That is, and it's too often the case that everything is reduced to a kind of homogeny of practices, which and you know, so many of my students in the university want to say, Professor Schweig, I know we're studying all these different traditions, but really, they're all saying the same thing. Do you know how many times I get that? Well, they're not saying the same thing. They're not. Krishna speaks very differently in the Bhagavad Gita than he does in the Hebrew Bible. He just does. That's why I'm here and not in synagogue today. I mean, today's Saturday, right? There's a different kind of expression here. So we're not here to have a meltdown of religious philosophies as if they were all the same. They're not the same. In fact, then of course in the West, we say, oh boy, are they not ever the same? They are conflicting. And therefore, one has to be right and the other has to be wrong. Now obviously, I'm going to be right and you're going to be wrong. And you're a little bit too much in my way, so I'm going to have to at least ignore you, pretend you don't exist, and, if necessary, kill you. And that's what goes on. Why can we not embrace differences? As the gopis, we're all different. The mandala is a perfect, perfect symbol of inclusivism first and exclusivism second. The Ras Lila Panchadhyayi, yes, it is the loftiest of Lilas, yes. And we are warned to be careful in how we approach this Lila, no doubt. Prabhupada has warned us. But yet there are such universal and important messages there that we cannot possibly overlook any further. The lesson of pride. As soon as we compare ourselves to others, just as the gopis did, right in the beginning, the first chapter of the Panchadhyayi, the gopis turned to each other after they were playing on the banks of the Yamuna with Krishna. They turned to one another and said, "We are the most fortunate women in the whole world." In other words, we're special as compared with the unspecial people. As soon as we compare ourselves to others, Krishna disappears. As soon as someone comes at you and tells you that you're going to hell for all eternity because you don't worship such and such, that is an unconscious, unwitting confession that they themselves are in hell. They are in the hell of comparing themselves to others. They are in the hell of hubris, of pride. They are in the hell of loneliness. They've isolated themselves from God. They've isolated themselves from other souls, the hearts of other souls. That is hell, in my definition. Tattvavit.
Yes, sir.
Did I answer your question at all?
Yes.
Oh.
No, I have another one.
You have another one? Yeah, we'll come back. Do you have a question or a comment? Yeah. Yes, I think I was using the idea of force with regard to the heart, that you can't force somebody to love you. Of course, I hear my undergraduate students walking across campus, and you know, you hear things, you know. So two girls are walking along and say, you know, does such and such, you know, really love you? And she turned to her girlfriend and said, "Of course he does, or if he doesn't, I'll kill him." And I'm thinking, very interesting. Yeah. Does he know that? You know? And if he does, what kind of love would that be? There's no question of forcing love. Love by its very nature is something that issues forth naturally in a free-flowing form from the heart. It's something that happens out of attraction and affection. And thank you. And it's something that is ultimately the most natural thing for us to do. It is most natural for us to love others and to love God. But we're fearful of that. We're fearful of that because we've been hurt in love. We've been disappointed from day one. As wonderful and as beautiful as our mothers may have been, as we grow up, we become disappointed even a little bit. No love in this world is going to be completely satisfying to us. But once we hear Krishna's call to love, then all other loves can be just wonderful. But when we lack the love of God, then all loves become painful. So it is amazing how our tradition is all about a fullness of heart. That is what we're here to do, is to fill up our hearts and to let our hearts just give out so much affection to others. But we do that by going to the divine heart. We can have an endless supply, a little bit like solar energy, right? There's an endless supply of the sun, and therefore endless supply of electricity. We just need to set up the panels of our hearts to receive Krishna's divine love call. We need to set up our process of shravanam to receive the divine love call. Then there's endless affection we can distribute to so many. But not out of force. It has to start with the source. Not force, but source. How about that? Do you agree with that? You like it. Okay. So is that answering your question at all? Is that making sense? Okay, good point. Yes, there is for ourselves this sense of discipline, sadhana bhakti, vaidhi bhakti. No question about it. I'm not denying that I can love music, I can love the violin. But if I don't practice, you know how I'm going to sound? Awful. Have you ever heard someone play a violin that doesn't know how to play a violin? It is horrendous. You don't want to do that. We don't want to do that either in bhakti. We want to practice. And we practice, but we practice because we love music. We have to always remember why we're practicing. If we're practicing because, well, if I don't practice, then I'll go to musician's hell. Then that is no motivation to practice at all. Sometimes we've had parents tell us that you have to practice, right? Parents will make us practice music. But again, is that the real reason to practice? No. The reason to practice is for the love of music. And so we can make beautiful music. We're here to make beautiful music with our hearts in devotion to Krishna. And if you find someone else not practicing who is here, it is not that you condemn them because they are not practicing. Because then you are participating in not practicing yourself. You are participating in their weaknesses. Why not draw from the source? You know, where's your solar panel? Give them some electricity. Inspire them, love them, care for them, be compassionate toward them. There's no question of condemning or judging another devotee. All those lists in Rupa Goswami's Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, we think they're there to checklist. Okay, Mahadyuti, let me look. Are you attaining to bhava? Okay, number one, no. Number two, not really. Number three. It's a stretch. We're not here to do that. We're not here to measure other devotees' performance. No, that's for us. That's part of the discipline. When I'm practicing violin, I'm not looking over at someone else while they're practicing and whacking them with the bow. How can you say that you're practicing and then your bow breaks, and what kind of music can you make with a broken bow? What's that? Yeah. Yeah, the instrument of penance and forgiveness and so on, begging forgiveness. But yes, we practice the bhakti. The bhakti practice, again, we must make sure that we don't become enemies to our own practice. And what to speak of to others' practice. That is important. Any other comments or questions?
In the beginning of your lecture, you spoke about how in Vedic society, the Vedic scriptures are not automatically guided in a particular
way. Yes. Correct.
My experience is that for a lot of devotees, finding a place, how is this managed for the rest of the ashram, is one of the biggest challenges.
Yes. Oh yes, I've seen devotees bounce between the ashrams 20 times at least in a week. But it is a worthy search. Because ashram and varna is for the purpose of harnessing one's talents and abilities and proclivities in seva, in loving seva for Krishna. Oh yeah, one time I saw a brahmachari, and the next day he had on all white, and then the next day he had saffron on, you know, obviously a little confused which way he was going to be. One day he had saffron kurta and white dhoti. So I suppose the upper half was brahmachari, the lower half, grihastha. And then I saw saffron dhoti and white kurta. And I realized when I saw this that this is obviously, this is good. This is good. In Vedic Varnashram, this is not good. In Daiva Varnashram, this is good. Let's not get stuck in this. Life is short. Life is very, very short. In Vedic times, it was very long, or much longer. In this age, see, in Vedic times, if you came back, which you did many, many times, and you progressed upward, that was good. You came back to a good society. Here? Coming back here? Well, coming back here would be very nice. I would love to be the little toddler, little mid-sized human for a set of parents in this community. That would be great. But I have no guarantee I'll make it that way. So the best thing to do is to become absorbed in our essential task of filling up one's heart with the divine love call. Ashram can then facilitate that. But yes, it is one of the hardest things. It is one of the most challenging things. But it's especially challenging if we see it apart from seva. Grounded in seva. Establish strength in seva, in ashram and varna. That is the only purpose in this age for varna and ashram. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took up the danda for one purpose, to convince the intellectual class of persons. I remember sitting late at night, I would sneak out in the hallway with the devotee at night. And as the Chaitanya Charitamritas were being produced, one every 2 weeks, we would read late into the night. And I remember reading this passage about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taking sannyas to convince the intellectual class of persons. And it was at a time, 1975, it was at a time when Prabhupada wanted some of us to represent Krishna consciousness to the intellectual class. And so, Ravindra Sarup, he was there, the president at the time, he came to me one day, he said, Prabhupada wants to start graduate studies or Bhagwat University in Mayapur. We just got word from Jai Patakmar. So he said, and I'm supposed to be the president of that college. So why don't you become the first student? I said, okay. And so I said, then I would have to finish 1 year left. First, I dropped out of high school. I don't even have a high school diploma. They call that a high school dropout in America, you know, high school dropout. So I have no high school diploma, but then I went back into college somehow a year early. And then I dropped out of college because I was attending Mangal Arati every morning and I was too tired to go to classes, so I just dropped out. It was a practical move. So I dropped out of college, and so Ravindra said, well, you're going to need to have a BA. You can't go to graduate school without the BA. So I found an American university. I was at Johns Hopkins first, and then I quit that, and then I went to, then I found in Washington, D.C., where I could do it quite easily and finish up. I just went there once a week, did all independent studies, got all A's, got out of there, you know, and would just stay at the temple in Philadelphia. So what happened was, is that, and so I'm going to school like this in the first part of this first semester. I had 2 semesters to go. And suddenly, Ravindra comes to me and says, apparently, Prabhupada canceled the whole project. Here I am going to school. I mean, it was not fun. You know, it was, you know, work and effort and so on. So I said, so why am I doing this then? So I was thinking, do I drop out of college yet a second time? So there we are, reading the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and it becomes apparent to me. The danda of the age is the PhD. And at this time, Prabhupada was also starting the Bhaktivedanta Institute. But most of that was a focus on hard sciences, not the soft sciences. So I was involved with that as well. So I said, okay, I'm reading the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Prabhupada clearly wants a certain kind of pursuit of intellectual work. I'm going to conduct an experiment just kind of on my own, just see what happens. I'm going to apply to the best schools in the country as a devotee and see if they'd even be willing to take me. So, you know, on every application, you have to state as a statement of purpose for graduate school. And I started off, you know, I am an initiated priest for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, known as the Hare Krishna Movement. I figured if they can get past that line, if they can get past that line, then, but if they want to throw the application out, fine with me. Why do I want to end up in a slaughterhouse? So, the idea then is, I applied to 4 schools, and I amazingly, surprisingly, astonishingly, got into 2 of them. I really didn't expect to get into any of them, which would then have finished any kind of academic enterprise, and I would have then dropped out yet a second time of college. But I said, wow, look at this. I ended up going to the University of Chicago. This was the place for Bengal studies, for Bengali Vaishnava studies. The place. Big professors. Hans von Buitenen, A.K. Ramanujan, Edward Dimmock, and others in the Divinity School. So I kind of saw this acceptance, which, by the way, was amazing because they required the graduate record examination. And they wrote back to me, said, we have everything, but we don't have your GREs. Do you know what that is, the GREs? It's like you take SATs for college. It's the exam you have to take in order to, that most graduate schools require. Some don't. So I thought University of Chicago was one that did not. Now, University of Chicago, for those of you who don't know, it's one of the top 10 schools in the country. It's a very high-powered school. Professors there are always winning Nobel Prizes and so on. But so, and it was the best place at the time for Indic studies, really. So they said, we need your GREs. Please send along. I wrote back. I said, I'm choosing not to take them. I'm opting not to take them because they're not required. They wrote back, sir, please look on page 6. In huge letters, all departments require the GREs. I wrote back and I said, please dispose of my application. I do terribly on these exams. I hate these exams. They're reductionistic. I hate them. Throw my application away, please. They wrote back. They say, please send us your GREs. I said, excuse me. I just told you. So I called up. I said, you know, either throw it out or process. I don't care, but I am not taking those exams. You know, my son gets 800s, perfect scores on these things. I get like 200s or maybe 250. I don't do well on these exams, so why take them, you know? So I was amazed, but they ended up processing my application in any case, which they never do. So it was quite obvious that I'm supposed to. So anyway, I still wasn't sure whether I should do this. So I checked it out with my GBC. You know, my local GBC. You know, you've got a problem, you go to your local GBC. So it was Rupa Nuga Prabhu at the time. So we went and we talked about it. I sat and I told him about my realization in the middle of the night with the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Does Prabhupada want this? Should we write to Prabhupada? Should we talk? And he sat there very gravely, looked at me, and he said, "This is fantastic. You should do this. You must do it." I said, "Really?" I said, "Should we check this out with Prabhupada just to make sure?" I mean, do it. So I did it. And then a semester later, into getting a master's degree at Chicago, Rupa Nuga calls me up and says, "You know what? I have no idea if anyone else in ISKCON's ever going to do this. You really need to go to Harvard." I said, "Why? This is a much better place to go to Harvard. Trust me. Everyone knows Harvard. Harvard, everyone bows to Harvard. Everyone offers homage to Harvard. So I said, "Okay." I applied and I got in there. So off I went to Harvard. So that's how it all sort of began. Why did I talk about this? The Danda, the Chaitanya, right, whatever. So the idea then is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't take sannyas for ashram merely. He took it to pursue seva. And look what he did with Keshava Kashmiri Pandit, Prakashananda Saraswati, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Those were my three models, by the way. When encountering a scholar, you can do one of three things. You can listen to them 7 days and seven nights, let them wear themselves out. The Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya method. You can be so humble and so beautiful and so effulgent, sit in the doorway of your professor's office, like Prakashananda, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did, Prakashananda Saraswati. So that's the behavior one, right? Preaching by behavior. Or you can go to defeat them on their own terms, in their own science, with Keshava Kashmiri Pandit, right? Those are the three methods. You don't know how many times I've meditated on these three, grasping onto this. Who was there to talk to about all those years in graduate school, 3 master's degrees and a doctorate later? I mean, a virtually, you know, over-educated idiot, essentially. You know? And you know, this was the process. How to manage. It was a lonely service all those years. It was lonely. Who do you talk to about this kind of stuff? My mother. I think he's right. Yeah, I think he's right. Yeah. So that is the point of ashram. Simply to facilitate seva. I'm really over here. I mean, not only over the top, but I mean over time. Is how long is this supposed to go on for? Till 10? Oh, okay. You have long classes here, don't you? Yadunandanaji, you are forcing bhakti on these poor devotees here, huh? How will you cultivate their hearts so sweetly? By forcing them, especially in this situation.
We just let
the
scholar wear himself out.
Yeah, very good. Yes, yes, very good. Very good. Excellent.
I want to go with the question on Sanskrit.
Since Sanskrit. Okay, let me just find out if there's anyone else that has any comments or questions. Because Tatvavit and I can go all day long. I'm sure we will, if you're doing anything today. Anyway, yes?
You were talking about portion.
Yes.
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 What if you're getting forced?
If you're getting forced by someone else. Yes. You just say, "Stop it." If someone finds the need to force you, see, oftentimes it's a need that they have because they're insecure about their own execution. That's the only reason why we need to force someone else is because we're not terribly good at disciplining ourselves. So rather than face my own lack of discipline, it's so much easier to harass Tathavit, for example. You know, I'd much rather harass him than myself. So if you understand the psychology of forcing others to take up Krishna consciousness, then you yourself can have a great deal of compassion and say, Prabhuji, I see that you care about me so much. Thank you so much for caring about me. And inquire from them more. They seem to need to help you. So ask them, so what do you do in this situation? Inquire from them. What did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu do with Ramachandrapuri? I mean, Ramachandrapuri was trying to force Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to be a better sannyasi, right? To the point of even throwing sugar down on the floor to attract ants. What, am I remembering this correctly? Is that what he did? Right? So in a way, forcing is like that. Throwing the sugar down to attract the ants. Finding fault. Or even, not even finding fault, creating fault. I need to do that with Tattvavit because I don't want to look at my own faults. Much easier to create faults in Tattvavit. For example, his chada clashes with his korta. I mean, I can't even look over there. It's a terrible clash of colors. We're supposed to dress nicely in front of the Lord. Tattvavit. These are clashing colors, and my gosh, his socks are like yet another color. So, you know, I mean, how important is that? How petty is it? The issue here is, you know, what is my motive? If we're supposed to be engaged in unmotivated devotional service, ahaituki bhakti, ahaituki apratiyata bhakti, then the question is, what is a devotee's motive? Is my motive in criticizing Tattvavit's wardrobe to truly serve him, to help him, and to love him? Is that an expression of my affection for him? Or am I really using Tattvavit as a way of not dealing with my own inebrieties? If it's the latter, then hopefully Tattvavit will save me from the hell that I'm in, of forcing someone to take up this process. But if he's uncomfortable and he's very anxious, if I've put him in that anxious state, or if I've discouraged him in devotional service, then we both have problems. And this is where the problems come in. This is where the tensions come in. This then requires Yarunandanaji to come along and save the day. Garuda, how can you be so cruel to Tattvavit? He's colorblind, or whatever. You know, he doesn't know how to match and mix and so on. And he always dresses like a slob. There's no reason. There's no reason to criticize him this way. He's a wonderful devotee doing so much wonderful service. You hurt his feelings, you discouraged him. And then I say, oh, Yadunandanaji, oh, I'm so sorry. I did not know. I think it's because of my own faults that I needed to criticize Tattvavitji. And then Yadunandana goes to Tattvavit and say, don't pay attention to that creep, Garuda. He is just here for a day. We will get rid of him quickly, and we will not invite him back. In fact, he will be banned from Ratadesh. He will come here no more, and we will be peaceful. No, the idea is that he would come and say that Garuda is obviously working on some of his own issues, and so we must have compassion on him. Such criticisms are, in some sense, subconscious confessions of my own faults and my own inabilities. So I was trying to confess. I just did it the wrong way. I was actually asking Tattvavit for help by criticizing him. That's what I was really doing. I was asking for help. It's not really the right way to ask for help. Better to ask for help. But if we create such an atmosphere where we feel so intimidated to ask for help, then we won't ever do it. And the way we'll act that out is by criticizing someone else. I always maintain that if Arjuna were a member of ISKCON, he would be thrown out. If Arjuna were a member of ISKCON, he would be banned from the temples. He had too many faults, too many problems. Problems are wonderful because they give us a chance to grow. They're not, you know, we look at each other like, you know, you better be a pure devotee, because if you're not, I'm through. We've developed a spiritual codependency. I need you to be pure, so I don't have to be. You're my guru. I need you to be perfect and pure. If I find one fault in you, I'm destroyed. You know how often that happens? You know why Krishna shows us that the guru is not a perfect human being? Do you know why he shows us that? It's because they're not. They're not. We so much place the responsibility on others for our spiritual advancement. Radhika Raman, you better be the perfect scholar. Because I'm not. So you go ahead. Well, actually, that works in this situation. But the point is, see how I'm all ready to jump in. You see that? So the whole point is that we have developed really some sicknesses. We expect others to do the hard work for us. Someone was complaining to me. They said they were very disappointed in their guru recently. And I said, why? He said, because he was not saying what his situation was. I said, so you're disappointed? But why are you disappointed? He said, because I thought he was perfect. I said, where does it say in the Shastra that the guru is perfect? It says that they deliver the grace of Krishna. That is their main function. Guru is not perfect. Guru is perfectly delivers the grace of God. But guru may have all kinds of personality traits. Guru may have problems. If even a Mahabhagavat can fall down from reading the Sharidaka Mimamsa Bhashya of Shankaracharya, then nothing's sacred. The only one who does not fall down is Achyuta. That means one who does not fall down, to distinguish him from all of the tatastha shaktis that fall, that flicker. We have flickering tendency. So when I see my old friends and so on, I just assume that they've been just falling around like crazy. Yeah. Thanks. However, they are glorious souls. Yes, good. They're good. Yeah. But we are not here to count the problems. We're here, as soon as there's a problem, we say, oh, wonderful opportunity for me. Let me care for this Vaishnava, this wonderful devotee. Let me participate in his or her strengths. Let me serve that wonderful Vaishnava who has already done so much service. What a wonderful process. But we can't say that unless we've been filling our hearts up with the divine call, Krishna. He is facing us. He's not facing Radharani right now. He's taking time away from his lila, or at least that lila. He is facing us. I know that there's no way Krishna can stand there playing the flute while he's right next to Radharani. I know that is impossible, unless he is exercising his infinite compassion for us and wanting us to come to him. That is the only way he can stand there like that. So force, there is no force. Discipline, Yes. Self-discipline? Yes. Prabhupada says it is a voluntary process. He meant it. It is voluntary. No one has to be here. In fact, I think I'm gonna leave here right now. No one's forcing me to be here except the lady who said 10 o'clock. Who was this? We are all here because we want to be here. We should not be here if we don't want to be. And we should make it so we absolutely love being here. Any last minute comment, question before? Because I think this is going on too long. Oh, Tatva did, not you. Let's go over here, and then you and I will talk afterwards, okay?
Sure.
Yeah.
Short question. Steady culture was before Kalinga?
Yes.
When was
it? Yes, it is the era, before, when Krishna came, that was the end of the Dwapara Yuga, and then came Kali Yuga. The traditional dating is, 5,000 years ago. At the time of the Mahabharata war, and then that the finishing of the Dwapara Yuga, and then Kali Yuga continues from there. That was so short. We'll take top of this question.
Oh, good.
I made him happy.
Yeah. This is about your verse.
Oh yes.
And it's a Sanskrit verse, and I just want to see how you do this. The first line says Yopayati Shanaimaya, and the synonyms are she who approaches slowly.
Yes.
And in the translation, that doesn't really appear.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if you could synchronize it. Does it mean, does it refer to this by accepting services offered by the woman? Does she approach slowly and offer services?
Yes. That's very interesting. It's a very good observation. You're a real exegete. It's good talking about you. Yes, the idea is that I think there's an idea of seduction, approaching slowly. It's quite an image. So, and of course, a positively modifying the pronoun, ya. The relative pronoun, ya, is maya. Okay? So she is maya that approaches slowly.
Watch out. She is going to come.
Can you? That's the idea. So it's like approaching slowly, but then just like you may walk, very calmly, and then boom, through the well. The covered, the grassy well. But that, thank you for pointing that out. That's very interesting. So it's very colorful, the way the Sanskrit works here. But yes, approaching slowly. Well, I think we're approaching very quickly the end of this venue. Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.